Hello, everyone. Welcome to the bonus episode. And Dominic, you are being a brave little soldier, aren't you? Because you've got a cold and you've bravely struggled out of your sickbed.
I have.
That's your devotion to the Wangs.
Well, I think what it is the, you know, the last few days have been a trial for all of us, Tom.
So this is in sympathy with Her Majesty, is it?
Yeah, I think it's psychosomatic, to be honest with you. I think it's a psychosomatic reaction.
Well, you're like the Met Office, who are not putting out any weather forecasts out of respect, and all these other people who are not going to work out of respect. Well, Her Majesty.
That's right. There's a whole, somebody's compiling a list online of all the things that people are not doing out of, basically the ways people are weaseling out of things out of respect. And my version of that is, I'm having a terrible cold out of respect for the Queen. But Tom.
Well, I think it does you great credit.
Thank you. Now I want to get straight into something that I've been itching to talk about since we did those podcasts about Her Majesty. We talked in the second episode about It's a Royal Knockout.
Yes.
The lurid and implausible TV spectacular put on by your friend, Prince Edward.
He's not my friend. He's my liege lord, Dominic.
He's a great admirer of your books, though, isn't he, Tom?
That has nothing to do with it.
Prince Edward, I just recognise
that he's probably the best, you know, he's the best man to be king.
Right. And he's your liege lord. Would you say, Tom, that you are on Prince Edward's team?
I'd very, very much team Prince Edward, yes.
Because I have here a flyer from It's a Royal Knockout, and it is emblazoned with the words Prince Edward's team. There's a picture of Prince Edward in a striped shirt. No, he's in a striped shirt. He looks like a city worker from Wall Street, 1987. As a little quote, true, a new mistress now I chase, the first foe in the field, and with a stronger faith embrace a sword, a horse, a shield. It's by Richard Lovelace, to Lancaster, going to the wars. And on the right-hand side of this flyer, Tom, are a list of your comrades on Prince Edward's team. So do you want to hear who was on Prince Edward's team?
Yes.
John Cleese.
Good. I can imagine him. Yeah.
The then world mile and 2,000 metre record holder, Steve Cram, great athlete.
So he'd be very useful if we get cornered by enemy forces at Tewkesbury or somewhere like that. And he could kind of run and get reinforcements.
Another great face of the 80s, Electric Avenue star, Eddie Grant.
Eddie Grant, well, Electric Avenue, yes.
It's Brixton, isn't it?
Brixton. So it's all coming together. Brixton rallying for His Majesty King Edward.
Right. Now, a swimmer, a world championship gold medal winning swimmer, who I'm ashamed to admit I had forgotten existed or had never perhaps heard of, called Sarah Hardcastle. Do you know Sarah Hardcastle, Tom?
No.
Well, if there's sort of naval battles, she'd come in very, very useful.
But she's sister of Paul Hardcastle, who sung 19.
No mention of that at all. But you'll need someone to sing the anthem.
Yeah.
So also on Prince Edward's team in 1987 was Dame Kiri Takanawa.
Oh, wonderful.
The opera singer.
Yes.
So that's good. Obviously, there would be fisticuffs. So you'll be pleased to hear that you'd be joined by the world boxing champion Barry McGuigan.
Oh, Barry McGuigan, yes.
Face of Northern Ireland.
Yes. Barry Hearn would be behind him.
Was Barry Hearn Barry McGuigan's manager?
I think so. Yeah, I think he was.
Tom, how is it that we've done all these episodes and we still haven't done that episode about the history of snooker?
I don't know.
That we were planning right at the beginning.
Yeah, we were.
We're worried now. We've got too many overseas listeners and they'll just think we've gone mad.
Tony, our producer, wouldn't let us do it, would he? I think it's the only subject that he actually banned.
Yeah. We were going to do the history of snooker and Napoleon in Egypt as a double bill, weren't we?
Yeah, we were.
We were so proud of ourselves for that. Yeah. We said, rival history podcast would never, ever think of doing
Well,
that.
I thought actually this week with the history of Portugal, Queen Elizabeth II and the Loch Ness Monster, I thought was a
pretty good. Yeah, that's a good. Anyway, let's not get distracted from Prince Edward's team. The late Christopher Reeve, Superman.
This is a pretty potent force, isn't it?
It is. Tessa Sanderson.
Yeah, lovely javelin thrower.
Yeah, excellent javelin throw, gold medalist.
Great, famous giggle.
Very, very jolly person.
Jolly, very jolly, yes.
And Toya Wilcox.
Who was my neighbour in Broadchalk.
Really?
Yes.
Toya Wilcox lived in Broadchalk.
We lived next door to this house that was owned by Cecil Beaton, and Greta Garbo used to go there. And then, you know, he died, and it got bought by this Argentinian woman who'd been married to some English yachtsman or something.
Right.
And in the Falklands, we hoped that she might get arrested and interned because we didn't like her very much.
Tom.
And then Toya bought it. I must have told you about this before.
No,
Because my mother at Christmas was always very anxious about how to dress Christmas cards. Should it be Mr. and Mrs. Fripp? Should it be Bob and Toya? Was that perhaps a bit?
Yeah, Robert Fripp.
Yeah. Should it be Robert and Toya? It generated her huge, huge anxieties.
And how did she address them?
I think Bob and Toya.
Bob and Toya. So I don't actually know what Toya did to make her famous.
She was a chanteuse. It's the mystery.
Okay.
I think that was her famous song.
Well, Prince Edward's team, the official blurb says that she's both rock star and talented actress.
Yeah, so she was in Derek Jarman's Jubilee.
Oh yes, of course she was. She was. Now, the good news for you is that they have on this leaflet these big stars, but they also have some gaps.
Oh, great.
Sort of roles that unknown people will be playing. So do you want me to tell you what the gaps are?
Yes.
The gaps are the Crusader Knight.
Yeah, okay.
The White Knight.
Yeah.
And this one is for you, the Faithful Serf.
I'm happy to play that part.
And the Faithful Serf, the little blurb says, the honest, faithful, toiling serf works hard for few rewards on earth. To serve his master in is his task. Job satisfaction, best not ask.
Do you know, I mean, that's quite punchy coming from the royal family in the 80s.
Yeah, there's no downplaying the hierarchy there, is there?
The feudal structuring of the British monarchy there.
So I don't actually know, and this is to my shame, I know our producer Dom, dementedly, spent his weekend watching It's a Royal Knockout and was denounced by his girlfriend for doing
it. For being
it.
Weird.
Yes. But so I don't actually know who won.
Dom,
because
you know
there
who
were
won?
Four teams, weren't there? There were the four teams, Prince Edward's team, Princess Anne's team.
So Dom just said he got to part three, so he didn't actually know who won it.
Prince Andrew obviously had a team. And was there a fourth team? Maybe there wasn't.
Well, it wasn't Prince Charles. I can't imagine Prince Charles doing that.
Prince Charles didn't have a team, did he?
No.
Fergie.
Fergie.
Yes.
Fergie. She had that's a team. Right. She Fergie loved dressing up, didn't she?
She did.
She was always dressing up as policewoman, going out with
every
with
picture
Diana.
You ever see of It's a Royal Knockout has her in it laughing uproariously.
Chortling.
Yeah, chortling. Exactly. For a history podcast, we've slightly gone off piste with this, but I think it was important. It was an important ground to cover.
Right. So
yes.
That's an unexpectedly jolly opening because the notes that Sam has given us, it's all somber, shocking event that came very suddenly. How have you two gauged the national feeling over the weekend? Well, I've gauged it over the weekend because my big treat for finishing the book, did I mention I finished the book, Dominic?
Go on, Tom.
I finished the book, was to go to, I booked tickets for all 5 days of the Oval Test, which began on Thursday and finished yesterday. And the first day got wiped out by rain, so not a single ball was bowled. And then the second day got wiped out by the end of the rain. It's a very good joke.
Hey, I don't get that.
So the Queen died, and so they cancelled the Friday.
Oh, right. Oh, right. They cancelled the... Yeah. But then you resumed play on the Saturday, didn't
Correct.
You?
Correct. So they resumed play on the Saturday, and all the players came out before play started, stood in a line, black armbands. There was a minute silence. But the odd thing was that the minute silence, everyone stood and was silent for about 5 minutes because they thought it already started. So it was actually a 5 minute silence. And then they did the national anthems and everyone absolutely bellowed out God Save the King. It was a fabulous moment.
That must have been.
Yeah, it was a very intense, slightly raw atmosphere. And the match proceeded at a furious pace. I think both teams were, you felt that they were kind of going at it full tilt. And the whole match was over in, basically it lasted 2 days. It should have lasted five. So it was very intense. But Dominic, the football got cancelled, didn't it? Which you thought was right. And I guess you've been to more football matches than me. I thought it was a mistake. And I definitely thought that banning the last night of the Proms as well. And the reason I thought it was a mistake having been to the Oval, and I know that cricket fans are perhaps less likely to boo the national anthem than, say, at Liverpool or whatever. But I still think it was a mistake.
So I think the last night of the Proms is... Shutting that down was crazy. I mean, that would have been that really would have been a kind of raw emotional occasion. I suppose they might say the security issues are such.
Yeah, maybe it was the police advice on the police.
The policing issues are such that we cannot afford to have any major public events. The football, I suppose my thinking with that was that there are always idiots at football games. I mean, it depresses me to say that as a season ticket holder, but there's always somebody, you know. And I think it would have, you know, the headlines would have been awful. And again, there's maybe a policing issue. Games in London, you know, the police have their hands full as it is. So they might struggle to find the security for the matches, because obviously, you know, a big game has huge sort of policing requirements.
Well, so this is a shout out to Daisy, who I was at the Oval Test with, and who went to see West Ham on the Thursday night, because that was the day that the Queen died, and so it was too late.
So it's too late to kind of cancel the game.
Yeah. And she said that was a very, you know, everyone was bellowing out "God save the King" and "God save the Queen," all that kind of thing. And she'd season ticket holder, and she'd sat next to a bloke for 5 years, never spoken to him, and now they're the best of friends.
Oh, that's nice.
United.
So I had my own. If you've been reading your Daily Mail, Tom, you will know that I was in London on Friday. And
Yes. You walked into a pub and everyone fell silent to listen to King Charles.
So this is a true story. I went for a drink with Andrew Preston, Vietnam, yes, who came onto our podcast to talk about Vietnam and also talked about America's Crusades, two episodes.
Yeah.
So we've been friends for, I don't know, 25 years. And we had a long planned, you know, rendezvous to go for a few drinks and go for dinner. So we went to he got the last two seats. I pitched up at this pub, the Coach and Horses, near Berkeley Square. And in my sort of very, you know, some people might consider tragic way, I thought, oh, this is such a shame. I'm going to miss the King's speech at 6 o'clock. And I genuinely did think maybe they'd show it in the pub. Wouldn't that be brilliant? And I had this sort of what people would consider very much a Daily Mail columnist's fantasy that everybody in the pub would watch in reverent awe.
Take off their flat caps.
Right, take off their flat caps, exactly.
Yeah, stand.
So it got to 6 o'clock, and lo and behold, they turned up the sound on the tellies. People did fall quiet, and they did watch the speech. And at the end, people clapped. And I told this story to someone.
And you rang up the Daily Mail and said, I've got to clear the page.
Yeah. Well,
I've got a right royal patriotic thub-tumper.
So on Sunday, I was writing for Monday. And I was chatting to the guy, Oliver, on the desk about, you know, I don't know, we were just wittering about this and that. And I told him this story and he said, well, there's your intro. Put that in. That's amazing. Put that in. And I sort of thought at the time, I bet loads of people will say, well, that didn't happen. But it really did happen.
Yeah. It's like the small child on the bus, isn't it?
Yes.
You turned out to be Albert Einstein or something.
Well, all these people who say that their children's first words were, yes, why aren't we still in the EU, Daddy?
Yes.
Or whatever.
Yeah. Why, oh, why weren't they introduced proportional representation?
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
And I thought, you know, I've been quite surprised by the sort of how keen people are to make it a kind of public national occasion. You know, the gigantic crowds in Edinburgh, for example. And obviously there's a degree of it, people thinking, some of it is affection for the Queen. Some of it is affection for the monarchy. Some of it is, as it always probably has been in history, people thinking, well, this is an interesting occasion, you know, a great spectacle and a kind of once in a lifetime thing. I'm going to go and have a look.
Well, it's a bit like, you know, somebody's, if you stand and point up at the sky, everyone will gather around and stare up at the sky, and before you know it, you'll have a crowd.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And people do love a good queue, don't they? And this is yeah. I mean, this is kind of like the Olympics for queuing. It's going to be kind of 5 mile queues.
Aren't they saying that people will be queuing for 30 hours to see the...
But I mean, if you love a queue, this is the moment you've waited for.
It is.
I mean, this is...
So at first, when I read about the lying in state, I said to my family, do you fancy going down to see the Queen? Do you fancy? And then as I saw the reports coming in, I don't like a queue. So when I saw that you'd be queuing for 5 hours, I said, oh no, I've lost. And I definitely wouldn't queue for 30 hours. But they're also saying children shouldn't go, aren't they? Because they won't get to go to the toilet. They won't be able to sit down because the queue will be constantly moving.
Well, they could just wet themselves and add to the patriotic jollity of the occasion.
Right.
Stench of urine drifting over.
That's nice. That's nice.
Anyway, should we look at some messages on the Queen's episode?
Yeah, let's.
So Doreen Wilson, I can't remember which recent podcast featured Tom and Dominic agreeing that the Queen was the most boring of all kings and queens. It was the World Cup, wasn't it? The World Cup of Kings and Queens, where the Queen was a semi-finalist, I think.
Who was she beaten by? Athelstan?
Yes, I think she was.
Because Elizabeth I...
No, she was beaten by Elizabeth I.
Oh, right. It was Elizabeth Darby, wasn't it?
So of course it was. Elizabeth Darby.
Yes.
Yeah.
She'd win that now.
No, I mean, just to clarify that, because I also, I said I went to the Chalk Valley History Festival because I had to do a stand-in because Tracy Borman was sick.
You were reported again in the Daily Mail about this, weren't you?
Yes, I was. And I kind of did it as a, you know, best queen, all that kind of stuff. And I said the best monarch was the queen.
Yeah.
But specifying that judging her by the standards of the age in which she lives, that's the key. And I think that she was, you know, she's clearly not a boring person in private. You know, she has incredible knowledge. She was clearly very amusing. Paddington loved her. I mean,
yes.
But she, I think, you know, the heroism, quiet heroism of her life was mm-hmm. that she basically played a dead bat day after day after day after day. Dorian goes on to say that I've realized I want boring from world leaders, faithful service, humility, duty, drama free. I can't disagree with the assessment of boring, but I miss it already. God bless her. So King Charles, I should say now, he kind of basically pledged to be boring, didn't he, in his first address?
He did.
He said I'm not going to stop going on about architecture and plants and things, and I'm now going to be boring.
Well, he has to do that, doesn't he? I mean, and I'm sure he will, actually, because, I mean, it's not like he's not an idiot, so he knows that he knows the role he's expected to play.
So, Dominic, I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
So, was it 1997, Diana died?
Yeah.
And the nation was engulfed by a kind of faintly histrionic strain of grief.
Yeah, very histrionic.
And there were lots of more kind of uptight, repressed, conservative types who said, this is all mad, I don't recognise my country.
Yeah.
Do you think that this is the revenge of the repressed, uptight, conservative types and that Republicans are all going, I don't recognise my country? Do you think it's the kind of the mirror image of what happened in Diana? They're all going, everyone rushing around with a stiff upper lip.
Yeah.
Doffing their caps.
Yeah. I think Republicans, judging by, I mean, what are we judging by? Social media and kind of Guardian columns. I think sort of dyed-in-the-wool Republicans they've missed their moment. They're conscious that their moment has been and gone. That the moment they had dreamed of never actually materialized because the king acceded within, you know, Hugh Edwards said, we've got news from Buckingham Palace, the queen has died, the king is going to, and in that moment, you know, that was their moment. That's what, a millisecond between those two sentences. And of course, there never really was a moment. And I think what's irritating for Republicans, they're enraged when they see, I mean, I've seen so much abuse of Keir Starmer and the Labour Party on Twitter and so on, because Keir Starmer has been very, very, you know, God save the king, all this.
As political self-interest entirely dictates that he should.
Of course.
He would be insane not to.
Indeed, Nicola Sturgeon, Tom, the First Minister of Scotland.
Or even Sinn Féin.
Yeah. So I think I've definitely detected so what are we talking about in maybe 80-20? It's probably always pretty much been 80-20, I think, as long as there have been polls. I think what probably is irritating for Republicans is not so much the ardent monarchists. It's that sort of silent majority who are kind of, you know, they don't really think about it. They don't have tea towels with the Queen's face on it.
But they feel quietly moved. But that's what I meant about the Diana thing. That then it was everybody kind of, well, I say everybody, let's say 70% of the country, 80% of the country perhaps, emoting furiously. And perhaps now in the same way, everyone is slightly surprised by how like, you know, people from the 50s, everyone's behaving.
Yeah.
Quiet, sober dignity, queuing up for 30 hours, all this kind of thing.
So what's interesting about that is the extent to which at any given moment, and I was thinking about this a lot, about the way people behaved in the 50s or indeed in 1901 when Victoria died or whatever, how much people are almost consciously playing the part of actors in a national drama.
Yes.
You know, people, for example, go
into... It's a Pathé News, isn't it?
Yeah, but people, I think there's a sort of sense that we've seen, you know, in documentaries, Pathé News, real clips of the death of George VI or something. And there's a sort of willing element of role-playing in... I mean, I think that's always the case, isn't it?
I think that was true with Diana as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. People threw themselves into that slightly sort of tear-stained drama, didn't they?
Yeah, you get caught up on the kind of the surge of the crowd. But because kind of extravagant emotion is much more visible than sober, quiet reflection, I still think the mood of sober, quiet reflection is quite a kind of, you know, it's a craze that people are, you know, it's a kind of national mood swing that everyone's getting caught up on. Anyway,
yeah, so. I think that's all true. I tell you a thing about people, crowds. Andrew Preston, when we were having this drink, Vietnam.
Well, so he's Canadian, so his queen as well.
Right, we were chatting about this, and I said, is there any, do you ever think, you know, because I'd watched the Justin Trudeau apparently on the verge of tears announcing the news. And I said,
So do you think he's redeemed himself?
Yeah, I've never been a massive Justin Trudeau fan, but since he shaved his beard and outed himself as an ardent monarchist, I've definitely come around.
So what about the man who I think has had the best royal mourning of the lot? I think is President Macron. And let it not be forgotten that earlier this year he gave her a horse.
Did he?
Yes, at the Jubilee.
Crikey, I didn't...
Which is very François Premier behaviour.
It's very François Premier behaviour. Yes, so he... the French are terribly monarchist, aren't they? It's just that their president plays the part of the monarch. It's what we talked about in that in those French president podcasts, that France has this extraordinary system where they're famous for having executed their king, but they have constructed a political system in which they have the closest thing to an elected monarch imaginable. A bit like the United States, I suppose. The sort of the pomp of the French president, you know, is unparalleled.
So they do pomp well, don't they?
They do pomp well, but also they take it seriously, don't they? They take it really, really seriously. And Macron is absolutely a man who is always role-playing.
Yeah, and he's really, really good at it. He's playing the part of a French president mourning a British queen and doing it very, very
exactly.
Well. So it could be 17th
exactly.
century, 18th century, whatever. He's doing it very well. So Putin also sent a message, and Sinn Féin expressed their regret. But certain institutions have not covered themselves with glory, would you say? Of which the New York Times, perhaps.
The New York Times, shocking. It's absolutely shocking.
So you know, if you drop sugar on a cowpat, supposedly it explodes. And I just thought I'd mention the New York Times and watch you explode.
So they published a truly, I thought, ridiculous piece by a historian called Maya Jasanoff, a Harvard historian.
She's good, isn't she?
Well, is she?
She's quite good.
I mean, I've reviewed her books, Tom, and sort of given them 6 out of 10.
You don't get to be a historian at Harvard if you're rubbish. So did she have a case to make?
Her case was that the Queen was merely the fig leaf on a cruel and
a bloody retreat. So Mau Mau.
Yeah.
So the Mau Mau thing. So treetops.
In Kenya.
Kenya, where she was told that she was queen.
Mm-hmm.
As I remember, and I think I may have mentioned this on an earlier podcast, I think all but one of the people who were there, the Kenyans who were at the hotel then, ended up killed by the Mau Mau, something like that.
Killed by the Mau Mau, right, golly.
So the insurgency was kind of already lapping at that point. So, there's perhaps a case to be made there that...
But what's the case? What's the argument?
Well, the case would be that the show of pomp and ceremony and all that kind of thing served as a fig leaf for atrocities that were going on at the same time. So when people think of Kenya in the 50s, they think of the Queen at treetops. They don't think of internment and British war crimes.
I don't think if you stop someone in the streets and you said Kenya in the 1950s, what do you think of?
They wouldn't have any idea at all, probably.
Exactly. They wouldn't know. I think you got mad. But I think
it's unfair.
What the Queen obviously does is she presides over a period of decolonization.
Yes, and I think she does it well, and we talked about that in the episode, I think.
There are sort of... So the commentary that you get from the New York Times or from associated sort of American sort of ultra-politically correct academics is... I mean, she was the face of bloody colonialism. Well, I mean, within the first 10 years of her reign, almost all of the empire had been dismantled. And she presided over that. I mean, I'm sure she didn't kind of actively want it to happen, but she never tried to resist it. In fact, she tried to put the best possible face on it and to handle it with grace, I would say, as we discussed before.
And she was dancing in Ghana while segregation was still legal in the United States.
I'm trying to work out what the argument is. I think the argument would be, well, she should have immediately distanced herself from it.
I don't think it's about her personally. I think it's about the sugarcoating of the violence and bloodshed that attached itself to the end of empire and British self-congratulation that, unlike the French, the withdrawal from empire was not bloody.
But I don't think people say it's not bloody. They just say it's less bloody. I mean, I don't think that's unreasonable to point that out. It was less bloody.
Yeah.
I mean...
Well, except in India.
I've written about it in Never Had It So Good, which I heartily recommend to the listeners. There was a degree of bloodshed, but it's obviously much less bloody than the war in Algeria, let's say. Or, you know, there weren't war equivalents of the wars we talked about in the last Portugal episode in Angola and Mozambique.
But the sense I get is that it's, of course, it's not about Britain at all. It's all about America, because everything in America is about America.
You know what? There was a very, very interesting... It's constantly puzzled me why the New York Times takes the position it constantly does about Britain. I mean, to the point of parody. And then I read about 2 days ago a really excellent article by a guy called Ian Martin on a website that unfortunately he's called Reaction. So I was like, exactly the kind of website that I would read. But anyway, it's a sort of unheard type website. And he was talking in that about the New York Times and its strategy, basically, that effectively what the New York Times is trying to do is to outflank the Guardian among it's trying to drive up its British subscribers. It's got a definite policy of doing that. And its way of doing that is to outflank the Guardian and to offer even more sort of self-flagellating content and opinion than the Guardian does. As the guy said, as Ian Martin said, the difference is that the Guardian doesn't hate Britain. The Guardian wants Britain to be different, but the New York Times has sort of outflanked that by basically presenting everything in Britain as absolutely abject. And in a way, what that is, of course, as you were just saying, is what they're really talking about there is America, aren't they?
Of course.
They're equating Britain with a kind of, I mean, they've got a fantasy image of Britain, which is a sort of Trumpish, WASP, ultra-Republican, you know, sort of a version of America. And by attacking Britain, it's sort of a way of attacking what they see as kind of, I don't know, Republicans or something.
Yes.
Anyway,
so is that enough about
the Queen,
do we think? I think probably.
You can never have too much about the Queen, Tom. That's very unpatriotic of you.
There is an interesting question from Matt CB75.
Yeah.
I'm probably swinging against the tide here, but I keep being told how big a moment in history this is. But is it really? Shouldn't that be reserved for things that actually change things? Has the actual changing of the monarch really changed things for most people in this country at any point? I mean, no, on one level it hasn't at all,
yeah.
Of course. But I suppose it's a bookend, isn't it? In Britain, we tend to use monarchs as... their accession and their death tends to bookend periods if they've reigned for a long time. So the Victorian period, the first Elizabethan period, Georgian period, and I'm sure this will be remembered perhaps as the Elizabethan period.
I think that's absolutely true, Tom. I also think, I replied to this on the Discord. I think what's so interesting is when people remember what happened in their lives, they often don't remember the events that historians think they should remember.
No. So it is all kind of Olympics and Jubilees and World Cups.
It's Olympics and Jubilees and World Cups, yeah. And actually, you know, let's say the death of Victoria in 1901. I mean, that was a massive event in Britain. And it would be weird to just say, well, I mean, obviously it changed nothing at some basic level, but that doesn't mean it doesn't matter.
Well, there's also Nick Sherrard. It does all feel very historic, he thinks. But I have this feeling where whenever I see Charles looking all regal and doing his ceremonial bit, I can sort of already hear the voiceover in the future documentary in the voice of some future Dominic, but there was trouble round the corner. And that's very much the role that the death of Victoria plays, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely that, yeah.
So Victoria dies. You know, so James Morris's brilliant trilogy about the British Empire, the first book ends with the death of Victoria.
Yeah.
And then you've got it all to come.
But just 13 years later, Kaiser Wilhelm II
wearing
the wrong shoes. absolutely. So let's talk about Portugal, Tom, because our final Portuguese episode was slightly overshadowed, wasn't it? By the death of the Queen. So we did our four episodes. Well, there was an awful lot of talk about the accents.
Yes. So this episode is brilliant. Thank you, Johnny. But Tom's pronunciation of Amelia Rodriguez.
No, that's Spanish again. It would be Amalia Rodriguez.
Left my Portuguese wife cold. She shouted, "She's not Spanish." Sandbrook had to work hard to make up lost ground, but I reckon he got there. I'm putting my hands up. I have no idea what Portuguese
sounds
like.
So I think you constantly commented. You said you sound Dutch or you sound Eastern European. But then there were tons of people online who said Portuguese, as people always say, Portuguese sounds like Russians or Serbians or something speaking Spanish. So it does have this weird kind of, and actually somebody put up a clip online of a woman talking in Portuguese and a woman talking in Russian and saying how similar they sound. It was really interesting.
I am always happy to put my hands up and admit when I've been wrong.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to do that on this occasion.
You're softening me up for something, Tom, I know.
No, not at all. Not at all. I think when you get something wrong, you should say so. And I accept I got that wrong.
I noticed we got a bit of grief for Loch Ness. You know,
we did. We did.
A woman who said, I have to turn off. I couldn't listen to it because your pronunciation of the word
Loch. The Loch Ness Monster. Well, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because for us growing up in England, Loch Ness Monster is something that you've probably spoken since you were a child. Yeah. You've never thought of it as Loch Ness Monster.
That's true.
It's Loch Ness Monster. It's just how you say it. I guess in the way that people from Yorkshire would describe, would talk about Bath. Don't you think? I mean, I don't mind people from Yorkshire calling Bath, Bath.
No, I mean, if we did a podcast about the history of the city that's the capital of Italy, we wouldn't call it Roma.
I suppose that's slightly different because that's a foreign language. I mean, the point is, should you...
Yeah, but I don't speak Scots or Gaelic or...
Is it disrespectful to not adopt the accent?
I think in England, I think people would say you sound absolutely ridiculous if we went around talking about Loch Ness.
And I thought we showed our respect by not putting on comedy Scottish accents when
quoting... Yeah, I thought that was very respectful, actually.
I thought we showed great restraint.
What about Joe Perowans? Have you seen this comment? I thought this was... So Joe Perowans loved the Portugal podcasts and liked the unvarnished history of the discoveries, which we tend not to get in Portugal. But Joe says, if Dominic were Portuguese, this would be the type of history he would object to. It would be seen as political correctness gone mad. Tom, do you think that's fair?
No.
Would you object to it?
What, to saying that awful things happened?
Yeah, about hanging dead fishermen from masts. I don't think I'd object to this sort of history. What I would object to...
is the hand-wringing.
It's the tone in which you discuss it, exactly. So I think I don't like a hand-wringing tone. And
history is basically bad shit happens, isn't it?
There's a lot of violence in history, Tom. We talked about this with Dan Carlin, didn't we, when we were on his podcast. And some people said, oh, this is... I noticed, because I saw some of the comments on the YouTube, when he put his clip on YouTube, some of his American listeners said, oh, this is typical British colonialists, you know, they don't care about violence. I mean, the truth of the matter is, history from start to finish, going back to the very first, the oldest episodes we've done, or the oldest, furthest back in time, the birth of Babylon, or, you know,
Neanderthals.
Alexander the Great, or the Spartans.
Neanderthals were, you know, ooh, let's have a punch up.
I think there's an awful lot of violence. And I think if you're going to approach it in a slightly sort of joyless, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say I'd approach the violence in a joyful mood, but I think if you approach it in this sort of mood where you're going to be shaking your head constantly, it's just not, what's the point? I mean, it just seems completely pointless to me.
Well, but what about the Nazis?
Well, that's a very fair question.
Or say apartheid, the history of apartheid.
Yeah, of course.
I think it would be difficult. Or indeed, the history of slavery.
Well, we've talked about this. I think we've touched on this before, but never massively kind of got into it, which is that I think, even though most people don't really admit it, I think most people observe a statute of limitations on historical violence. Don't you? So in other words, you're telling the story about Basil the Bulgar Slayer.
Yeah.
And you say he killed all these Bulgars. You know, or the Pechenegs cutting people's heads off and turning them into goblets. And almost everybody tells those stories as an absolute laugh.
Well, it's interesting. So I would say the slave trade is different to that. So
yeah,
that is something that still has a kind of
a
moral resonance. And what I've noticed is that, so there's this thing of not calling slaves, calling them enslaved peoples, but to call them slaves immediately is adopting the perspective of the slaver, it is said. And I've noticed that in books on Roman slavery, this is now becoming the thing. So people talk of enslaved peoples in Roman households. That's quite a long time ago.
There's a hell of a lot of enslaved peoples in history, Tom, if you're going to take that. I mean, most societies have had some form of slavery, haven't they, until about 1500 or so?
So I would say, I mean, I don't think over most of history, I'm going to call them slaves, because I think the perspective of the slaver is not so different for most of history from that of the slave. Slaves, for most of history, did not object to slavery as an institution. They objected to themselves being slaves, but they'd have been perfectly happy about themselves owning slaves. I mean, that's certainly the case in the Roman
world.
In Rome,
presumably you become a freedman and then you hope to own slaves yourself. Is that right?
There were slave revolts in Sicily in the 2nd century BC, and it's absolutely apparent from those that what they objected to was the fact that they had been made slaves. These were Greeks, by and large, and they felt that they shouldn't have been slaves. And they were being jumbled up with other people who should have been slaves, and that was very much their take. And I think the idea that slaves have not been as ready to take slaves to make other people slaves as anyone else is wishful thinking.
Yeah.
So anyway, but it's a very interesting topic, but maybe at some point we should do an episode on the statute of limitations in history and whether it exists and how far it should go back. And
well, the example, we gave the example on the, when we talked about classics from Mary Beard, didn't we? The Colosseum and Gladiators.
Yeah.
People love Gladiators. They love the film Gladiator. They love visiting the Colosseum. But of course, as you say, if these had been slaves from the 1800s, people would be absolutely appalled.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But because it's in distant past, they don't care. I mean, it's brutal, but that's the truth.
Okay, here's another one from Relax OK.
Oh, yeah, shocking.
Dominic's continued attempts to make Salazar seem good were troubling.
Do you think
Dominic.
That's true? Do you think that is fair, Tom?
Also surprised no comparison was made to Putin, who also enjoys great
popularity. That's a fair point.
Despite being incredibly repressive. Well, there are a lot of parallels, actually. I mean, if you're looking for that, for someone with dictatorial instincts who nevertheless manages to kind of window dress himself.
Yeah.
As someone less dictatorial. We cited Augustus. I think Augustus and Putin, though, you know, the parallels there are interesting. I do think it's a bit unfair, but I don't know enough about Salazar to know how unfair.
I thought a lot about Salazar and how to talk about him before we did that podcast. Because I think on the one hand, he's somebody who is who's deeply undemocratic, who doesn't believe in democracy at all. Doesn't believe it's right, doesn't believe it's Christian. But wants to turn the clock back to a kind of lost medieval world, pre-Reformation world. Salazar doesn't believe in free speech. He doesn't believe in, you know, free elections. He has an apparatus of repression, all of these kinds of things. I mean, I don't think that that's making him seem good, but I think it's mad to say he's evil as Hitler was, because of course there's a massive divergence. So the point is, I think I said this on the Discord, I guess most rulers, most people who've ever ruled societies before the year 1950 were not Democrats. They were what we would call, I suppose, they were to some degree dictatorial. I mean, they might have been hemmed in by institutions of various kinds or dependent on elites or whatever, but actually that's true of lots of dictators as well. So do you say they're all villains? Are all medieval kings or emperors? Are they all bad? Because they have instruments of repression. They suppress free speech. They don't like elections. I mean, they're not all villains. I mean, obviously, you know, Salazar is a more, compare him with Franco. Franco is incredibly corrupt. Franco is very repressive. Franco is violent.
And came to power in a civil war.
Salazar comes to power. Okay, he's appointed after various coups and stuff, but coups that he is not, you know, he's not really taken part in. Salazar is professorial. He's serious. He's all these kinds of things. I mean, maybe I think it's unlikely I would be his friend, you know? And it's unlikely I would ever vote for him. But I think he's obviously not Mussolini or Hitler or Stalin.
But you wouldn't vote for him to be top Portuguese, would you?
No, I wouldn't. I absolutely wouldn't. I would. I think it's odd.
And who would you vote for?
To be the top Portuguese of all time, who would I vote for? Who would you vote for, Tom? I'd vote for, would you vote for one of the explorers? I mean, they're quite bloodstained, aren't they? I think it would be, would you vote for Henry the Navigator? I mean, he today would be tarnished with the sin of imperialism, wouldn't he? So
I think Philippa, Queen Philippa.
Oh, yeah, very good. I don't know who I'd vote for. Maybe I'd vote for a fado singer.
Yes. Or maybe the first Bishop of Lisbon, who came from Bury St. Edmunds.
What was his name? Yeah.
Gilbert of Sussex or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Gilbert of Suffolk. Loch Ness Monster. David, top Reverend Nicholson, as a native Gaelic speaker, must congratulate me on pronunciation of Loch.
That's nice, Tom.
Column killer.
You've had a lot of abuse for your...
right up there with our mnemonic stab at the Gaelic. So that's good to know, me and Prince Charles.
That's great. I'm pleased for you. You've got some good publicity for your accents at last.
And to finish, this was very odd. This was very, very odd. So a very odd thing happened this week, which was... It was over almost a year ago, wasn't it? It was this last December. Yeah. It was when the Ashes
started. Ashes.
We did an episode on the history of cricket with John Hotton. And at the beginning of that, I cited an article by an Australian-Armenian professor of early Christianity who had come across an Armenian gospel in which Jesus was described as playing a game that might conceivably, if you were writing it for an Australian tabloid, sound a little bit like cricket. Yeah. And so I quoted that and thought nothing more of it. And then suddenly it went all viral, and it was on the front page of the Daily Star, where Dominic, you and I and John Hotton were described as proper clever boffs.
That's
and
nice.
It got a mention on Greg James's Radio 1 show, so very odd.
Yeah, the headline, "Thou shalt not get skittled by a dibbly dobbly." What's that mean? I don't know what that means.
Dibbly dobbly is a kind of, it's a slow looping ball that then dribbles along the ground.
Do you bowl dibbly dobblies, Tom?
No, I bowl pace, Dominic.
Okay, fine. I believe you. But so that story would have been an even bigger story, but it was sadly overshadowed by the...
Well, it came out on the Wednesday.
Yeah.
And we were looking forward to see how that was going to develop over the week. And then I'm afraid it got kicked off the front page by...
Total Eclipse.
Coming up, what have we got? We've got, to reiterate, we've got the First Romantics coming on Thursday.
Is that what it's going to be called, The First Romantics?
Well, we don't know, do we? We've got to work that out. But anyway, listen to it because it's really, really funny and good.
I still like it. I still think it should be called Germans Behaving Badly.
Yeah, but that's the Gestapo, isn't it?
I suppose so. So it is very, it's a very, very jolly episode, that one. I hope people enjoy it. I'm looking at their schedule. We've got, I think Lady Jane Grey may be seeing the light of day soon, which is exciting.
Well, it's topical, isn't it?
Yeah, well,
a changeover of power.
Yeah.
So that's next week, is it?
I think so. We're still sitting on China and World War II. A few people have been asking about that. We're still sitting on that. That's yet to come. French films is yet to come. And I think we're going to be recording some episodes about Winston Churchill and Marilyn Monroe.
Aren't we, Tom? So something for all tastes.
Yeah.
Hope you enjoy them, and we'll see you very soon. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.